This is Ken Samuelson. I'm in Jamestown, North Carolina, with Mr. Kenneth James Gibby, who's a veteran of World War II. And I live at 545 Southwood Drive in Eden, North Carolina. My telephone number is 336-623-7787. And Mr. Gibby, could you identify yourself for the listeners?
I'm Kenneth Gibby. Born in 11-3-19.
1919.
Okay. 1919. Born in Springdale, Montana.
Okay.
And they moved back to North Carolina over in Swain County when I was just a baby.
I see. So born in Montana and moved to North Carolina when you were a baby.
Yeah.
And what was your, where do you live now, Mr. Gibby?
I live in Taylorsville, North Carolina.
And what's your address and phone number?
40 Land Cemetery Lane, Taylorsville, 28681. Telephone number, 8482.
That's okay, go ahead. Take your time.
5281.
There you go. Somebody might want to call you. You never know when they listen to this. Okay. So you moved here when you were just a very small child. Okay. So you went to school then in Taylorsville?
No. I was raised in Swain and Graham County.
Oh, okay, that's not Taylorsville.
And that was back during the Depression, and we couldn't find jobs. So that way, that's why I joined the Army.
I see. When did you join the Army?
I joined the Army in 1940.
1940, so that was before Pearl Harbor, obviously.
And I signed up for Hawaii for 2 years and 1 year back in the States. I wound up staying overseas 4 years, 6 months, and so many days.
Okay, well, let's see. What town was that where you were raised then? It wasn't Taylorsville, I take it.
Well, I was an old country boy. Bryson City was...
Okay, Bryson City
Bryson
was...
Bryson City and Robinsonville in Graham County.
Okay. So you grew up then on the farm? Is that the idea?
Well, yes. That's the only way we could make a living back in them days.
And what did you do? You helped your father and...
Farming? Well, my father got killed when I was 2 years old.
Oh, okay.
I plowed an old bull.
And you must have started when you were really young, huh?
We raised what we eat.
Uh-huh. And so times were very tough.
It was very tough.
And did you have a newspaper that you read when you were coming along, or did you know what was going on?
No, we didn't have nothing like that. We didn't have a radio. I didn't even have a bicycle my whole life, a tricycle, a scooter. I didn't have anything that most kids have today.
So you didn't get out of Bryson County much either, I guess, or Bryson City, I should say.
No, not till I was about 18 years old.
Is that right?
Then I come to Asheville, and I worked in Asheville a while under the Langer Hotel as a cook.
Uh-huh.
And then I moved on down on the Wilkerson's Boulevard between Gastonia and Charlotte and worked there. And I was working there when my step-nephew came by, and he had already had to register.
Uh-huh.
And I hadn't become 21. You had to register when you was 21.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me, he said, "Ken, let's go to the Army."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Okay." And we decided we'd go to Hawaii. So we went and joined the Army and went to Hawaii.
That was a pretty kind of off-the-cuff decision, huh? I mean, you just did it suddenly? You just decided to
Well,
join?
I I knew I was going to have to register when I become 21.
Uh-huh. So you thought you'd just go in early, huh?
So I become 21 in November of that year. It was very short, and I knew I was going to have to register, and he had already registered and was getting called any time.
Uh-huh.
So we just took off and went on.
So where did you actually join up? Did you join in Brighton?
Well, I had a sister that lived in Fort Benning, Georgia. And we hitchhiked over there. And my sister's husband was a master sergeant. And we got a little advice from him. So we just went on to Hawaii.
Uh-huh. So you joined up then in Georgia, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. And how did you get down there? Did you have a car?
We hitchhiked. Back in those days, people weren't scared of death. You could hitchhike, too.
Yeah, you said you hitchhiked down. That's right. Okay, so then you joined up, and how long did it take after you joined up until you actually, they put a uniform on you?
Well, I joined up at Fort Benning. They shipped me over here to Charleston, South Carolina, and I stayed there a few days, and then I got aboard that little old Chateau Theory at Charleston, South Carolina.
The ship Chateau Theory?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we sailed to Norfolk, Virginia, and then we went from Norfolk, Virginia to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And then we boarded the Washington. That was a big land cruiser, and we had staterooms on there. And it's the first trip they had ever made for the Army. The Army had just bought it as a troop carrier.
Now, excuse me a second. Did you take basic training anywhere?
I taken basic training after I got to Hawaii.
Oh, okay. So they just put you and shipped you over to Hawaii before you even took basic training.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then we left there, went to Panama Canal, went through the canal, back to San Francisco, and then to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
Taking me 30-some days on that trip.
Now, were you in uniform? Did you have any uniform?
Oh, yeah, they put us in uniform
right
there, full blank.
Okay. So you had a uniform, but you had no training yet.
That's right.
To speak of. Okay, so then you went to Hawaii. Where did you go in Hawaii? What
facility? I went to Schofield Barracks, to the 27th Infantry.
Mm-hmm.
And
now, this would have been what time frame now?
Well, I got there in February
of 41,
and I taken the 6 weeks training course, and then as soon as I came off of the training course, the first sergeant said, Ken said, your record shows that you've been a cook. He said, we need a cook in the kitchen. Said, would you agree to go in the kitchen?
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, I've been thinking about taking cooking baker school. He said, oh, don't never try that. He said, because you won't go down there and we won't do a thing in the world for the first 6 months and wash pots and pans. He said, if you know how to cook it at all, he said, we'll train you the way we want you.
Hmm. So you went into cooking baker, not the school, but you went into training at Fort Shafter, was it?
No, we taken our basic training before, when I first got to Hawaii, we taken our basic training.
You took your basic training, okay.
And then we had to take, it was a six weeks basic training, and then you're supposed to be a soldier.
Right, okay.
So I went in the kitchen and cooked, and then that picture right there was taken in November.
This one here?
That one right there was taken in October before the war started.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And The Hawaiian Department went on alert. The whole department went on alert in October, about the middle of October.
Okay, let's go back a little bit on your training. What was your basic training like? What did they?
Well, you had a drill sergeant, and he learned you to march.
Did you carry a gun? Did they have any wooden guns, or did they have a real gun?
No, we had a regular, we were full fill pack. We had a pack on and everything. We carried, did basic training. They issued us our gun and clothing and everything. Of course, we had our uniform when we left here, but then they give us a different uniform after we got to Hawaii because hot country over there.
Right, yeah. What kind of uniforms you wear?
Well, I wore them wool uniforms over here at that time of the year, but we got over there, then we took the summer uniforms, khakis.
Right, you had khakis. And you didn't have any shorts to wear or anything like that? Everything had was long pants, everything?
We had to be fully uniform back then. It was a lot more strict than it is today.
All right. Okay, well, tell me a little bit about your basic training. Now, did they give you experience on the firing range? You went out and fired.
Well, we had to go on the firing range and learn to fire, and we had to learn to hit the dirt. They train you to hit the dirt. Well, when you're under actual combat, they don't have to tell you to hit the dirt.
Right.
You don't look for a soft place either.
Right. Okay. So this lasted about 6 weeks. Did you have any free time, or were you pretty much in training like 24 hours a day? Or
no, we trained about. They could train you for an hour and then a 10-minute break.
Mm-hmm.
An hour and 10-minute break. It'd start about 8 in the morning and about 4 in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
But we was had to strictly stay right there in camp.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they had us in tents out in the quarters.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They didn't put us in the barracks till we got through complete training.
Okay, so you didn't have any free time then at all. You were strictly kind of regimented right from sun up till sundown.
No, not for the first 6 weeks, but after the 6 weeks, I could get a pass to go into Honolulu or any 24-hour pass.
Uh-huh.
That's the only thing I ever had the whole time I was in there. Never had a furlough.
Really?
So,
you never had any leave time at all, huh?
No. Well, I had plenty of time off.
Yeah.
As a cook, I'd work one day on and 2 days off.
Uh-huh.
And I could loaf around the camp, or I could even get a pass and go down to Waiawa or wherever I wanted to, just as long as I was back when I was supposed to be.
Right. So when you finished your basic training, did you feel like a soldier at that point?
Well, yeah, well, I guess I did. I don't know.
You feel like you were well-trained? I mean, in the...
I liked the Army. I really did. Until I went through with so much, and then the quicker I could get out, the better it would be.
So anyway, after your basic training, then you went into the cooks and bakers business, huh?
Yeah,
You became a cook?
I became a cook. And then, like I say, on the 20, in October, they made that picture right there. And then the war started on December the 7th.
Mm-hmm.
I was cook on duty. And about the tables, waiters had already come in and set the tables up. They would be two of us on cook, two cooks on duty. And they blowed an alert call.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the Hawaiian Department went on alert. They blowed that alert call, and everybody fell out, and they told them to go take 5 minutes, be back in 5 minutes, full field, ready to go. Mm-hmm. And the old first sergeant come in, he said, "Gibby," he said, "we're on alert." He said, "That was an alert call." Said, "We're on alert." He said, "You're going to have to pull all your food back," and said, "We'll send you a field kitchen." Mm-hmm. "On a big truck. We'll send that to it down here. You load everything in there, your field equipment and everything." Well, I never moved a kitchen out. My mess sergeant done went home.
Now, is this in October when you're talking about when you went on alert?
That's when we went on the alert.
Went on the alert, okay. Okay.
And we were supposed to defend Honolulu. So the rest of the cooks come in, and the mess sergeant, he done went home. He was married and lived down where you are. So us cooks had to get the field kitchen all set in and everything, and I had to carry all the food that I had cooked and down to Honolulu, and they stationed the men all around Honolulu.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to take, everybody had their mess kits with them, and we had to go around and hauling their food around and feeding the men.
Mm-hmm.
And around 12 o'clock that night, Lieutenant Burns, he was our mess officer, he come in at our field kitchen there, in Honolulu, and he said to me, he said, "Ken," said, "are you cooks not getting any rest?" I said, "How can we rest?" I said, "I just got through feeding the men." And he said, "Well, you better get all the rest you can, for," he said, "we're looking for the Japanese to attack."
So that was your first inclination that you thought the Japanese might attack?
That was our first. And the whole Hawaiian department was on alert. Navy, Marines, Air Force, everything.
Uh-huh.
Okay. On the last of November, they called that alert off.
Mm-hmm.
Straight out of Washington. Orders all come out of Washington there. And so everybody went right on back to their regular duties, except us. The 27th Infantry, we had Honolulu was our objective to take care of. And we were still on alert when the Japs come.
Mm-hmm.
And to cap it all off, there was a boy on that radar station up there that picked those planes up 180 miles out to sea.
Right.
He called his commander and told him. His commander said it's about 5 o'clock in the morning, or between 6 and 7, somewhere just before. Right. He picked him up 180 miles out. And he called him, and he said, "Forget it." Turned over and went to sleep.
Yeah, they thought there were B-17s flying in.
And then they blamed Kimmel and Short. One of them was over the Army, the other was over the Navy. But the blame all was in Washington.
Okay, so they called off the alert except for you. You still had to do what?
The 27th Infantry stayed right on in position.
Oh, okay. And what kind of information were they giving you other than the fact that apparently somebody told you, your commanding officer told you that the Japanese may attack, right?
He told me, now he was just talking to me.
Yeah.
because I was in charge of the kitchen at that night. He said, "Ken, ain't you cooks are getting in to sleep?" And he said, "You better get all the rest you can." Said, "We're looking for the Japs to attack us." And it's a funny thing to me, there's nothing ever said about that.
No, you kind of wonder about that kind of a comment from a relatively, you know, lieutenant or whatever he was, captain, that he would seem to know all that. But anyway, so you were on alert this whole time, and then what happened to you on December the 7th? Where were you?
Well, we was at Roosevelt High School when the alert went off. And they took me and my platoon that I was in, and they rushed us right down to the railroad station down there, not the station, but the switchyard. A big high bridge went across those railroad tracks between the Hawaiian Gas Company and the Hawaiian and Pineapple Company. And they put me on top of that bridge for an OP. So there I was. I had a ringside seat to all of it. I could see all over Honolulu. I could see all over Pearl Harbor, Hickam Field.
What did they tell you as an observation point? What did they tell you?
They told us the Japanese was attacking us before we left Roosevelt High School. When they come blow the alert, we fell out.
Why were you at the high school? What were you doing at the high school?
Well, that's where our headquarters was.
Oh, at the high school.
That was where our headquarters was.
Okay.
And we had men stationed all over Honolulu.
Okay.
And, well,
when you were up in this observation point,
I was up on that high bridge. There's a big high bridge went over the switch yard down there. Okay. Several tracks down there.
What were your duties? What did they ask you to do from that particular
observation? Well, if I see anything, I'm supposed to report it.
Okay.
And so the planes was already in it by the time I got there. And they was a bombing Pearl Harbor. They come in up at Schofield. They come in three directions. They come in they hit each one of them airfields. Mm-hmm. Now they didn't do too much bombing on the airfields. They went down a spraying those planes, knocking them out. Right. 50 caliber machine gun.
Right.
You know how the Army is. Everything dress right dress. They had them lined up, and these pilots flew right down and machine gunned them. Yep. They knowed they had to knock the Air Force out first. They knowed that. And all the pilots were in the mess halls up at Hickam Field and down at Rogers, down there at Honolulu and all. They were all in the mess hall eating. And when they got the alert, they come running out, and they tried to run to their planes, and they just mowed them down. There was one plane got off of the ground, and the pilot that took it off had to drive 20 miles to get that plane up. Of course, they'd done gone by the time he done all that.
Yeah. So you got a ringside seat of pretty much everything that was going on.
Well,
from where you were, could you see down at the docks at all? I mean, were you too far away to see that, I guess, weren't you?
It was a pretty good ways down there, but wasn't long whenever they hit those oil fuel tanks down there,
yeah.
And then they hit them ships, it was just mostly a big cloud of smoke.
Could you saw the smoke of all the explosions and everything?
Yeah. And that smoke, the wind, it was coming up right where I was at.
Mm-hmm.
And right before the planes left out, they were three planes headed for the Hawaiian Gas Company.
Mm-hmm.
And there it was, right there. And I was on that bridge. And they was flying low enough till I could see the pilots. And each one had two belly bombs, or two wing bombs and a belly bomb. Each one had three bombs. They come in there, they was low enough till I could see them. And they'd release them bombs. I saw them bombs coming too. It looked like my name was on every one of them.
I bet, felt that way.
And I wanted to run, but I knew the Articles of War, they taught us that right quick. If you leave your post in time of war, you go before a firing squad.
That's right.
So I said, well, if they're going to kill me, I might as well just hang in. So I just hung up to that bridge as close as I could.
Right.
And one bomb went through a Hawaiian pineapple company, no, the cannery, one through a soda water factory over here. One hit that smallest tank. There was two big tanks.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was 180 feet off the ground, the other one about 160. Big tanks.
Mm-hmm.
They hit that smallest one right in the top.
Mm-hmm.
It was about half full when they hit it. Well, the gas company started draining it right away because they had big underground tanks they drained the gas into.
Mm-hmm.
And it just hit, and it just like that. If it had hit the side, I wouldn't be here today.
You wouldn't be here today.
But the fumes from that burnt 24 hours after they got all the gas out, there's enough fumes in that tank. It just lit the whole area up.
Mm.
Don't you think I wasn't scared?
What a spectacle. You got a ringside view. You wish you hadn't, I'm sure. So how long did you stay at that post? Were you there
for? Well, we stayed there just a few days, but then just after the planes left, it came over the loudspeakers and all the radios that we were surrounded by Japanese paratroops.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know how rumors start, and you know how fast they can run.
Where did you hear that from?
Who? We heard that, our officers come and told us.
Okay.
And we were scared. Sure, we thought we were surrounded, you know. Everything moved, we shot at it.
Oh,
they were dogs killed and everything, cats. And that night, it was blackout. No lights, none whatsoever, but a blue light. That's all you could have. If you had a flashlight, you had to get blue paper and put over it. That's the only thing, anything bright, we shot it out.
Had you had any blackouts before that night?
No.
No blackouts at all?
And it was blackout, I guess, I stayed in Hawaii for almost a year after. And it was blackout. The towns was black. Everything was black.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the comical part about, we was trash on earth in Honolulu. Soldiers was... Serviceman was trash on earth. But we was the most precious things you ever saw after that happened. Till they decided, well, okay, the United States is able now to defend us. And it got right back the same way.
So it was short-lived, huh? Being a hero. So you stayed Hawaii then for a year?
Almost a year. And then we trained to hit the Solomon Islands.
Uh-huh. Now, were you still a cook then at that time, or did they...
No, when the war started, I went right on straight duty.
You became a rifleman at that time?
Regular soldier.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you were training then, and did you get training specifically for invasions of the islands and so forth?
Yeah, we trained probably 6 or 8 weeks, something like that. And they told us that we were going into combat. They didn't tell us exactly where. And whenever we traveled, we'd travel 15 minutes this way, 15 minutes that way, and then back 15 minutes this way. It took a long time to go. Because they figured it'd take at least 15 minutes from the zero in on your ship, see. And we'd go in big convoys. We had aircraft carriers. We had big battleships and little cruisers and all. We were in staggered formation all the way, but...
Okay. Getting back a little bit to your year after, you know, after Pearl Harbor, December 7th, in your training, now, were you training for a full year until you left there, or were you doing something else, too? Were you training basically the whole time?
No. After we left that place at the railroad there, why, we went up to, and I forgot the name of that little fort right on the other side of Waikiki Beach.
Shafter?
Huh?
Shafter?
I don't remember the name of it at all. Okay. 60 years makes a lot of difference. And we strung barbed wire. They called Constantinas, rolled up.
Yeah,
we put them all the way up Waikiki Beach, around Diamond Head, all around through like that.
Okay, so you actually were trying to defend against an invasion.
We were defending Honolulu. And then after, then they decided, well, we're going to move you on out. So we went up back up to Schofield. And started training.
What was the environment like, you know, living there, you know, with the war having started? What was it like then? Did you feel pretty vulnerable there, out there in the middle of the ocean, that, hey, I might really, you know, be attacked? We might really be attacked by the Japanese? Did you have that feeling?
Well, there was plenty of submarine, enemy submarines out in that ocean. And that's the reason we zigzagged. And we had a few air shows out there. They'd come over and try to bomb us, and our airplanes would go up and intercept them.
Right.
And we did have some ship damage. Well, not on the ship I was on, but they was some ship damage in the convoys.
Now, when you were doing your training for the invasion, did you get into a ship offshore then and get onto like an LCVP and go in and actually do a mock landing?
No, we didn't do that at all. They just told us what was what. Whenever, of course, when we got aboard ship, they told us how we would get off. That rope ladder, we would go down that rope ladder into the amphibious, and making beachheads like that. But when we went to there, the Marines was holding a 12-mile beachhead at Guadalcanal, and they was holding that little airfield, and that's all they had. And we had no problem of going in when we went in to Guadalcanal.
Did you know before you went to Guadalcanal that that's where you're going to go?
We didn't know just before we got there. Then they told us.
So you were kind of wondering where you were going, I guess.
Yeah. Well, we knew we was going to combat.
Yeah, but you didn't know specifically.
We didn't know exactly where.
Yeah.
And whenever we got, the ships could go only so close in, and we had to go down them with a four-fill pack, everything.
Right.
Go down those rope ladders into them amphibious boats.
Right.
And they would take us as far in as they could get us.
Right.
Well, they wasn't that amphibious. They were just them landing boats.
Yeah.
Them amphibians, they could go on ground. They had wheels. They could go.
Yeah.
I rode them too. So, but there we just had to jump out when that ship get as far, the boats get as far as they could, sometimes in water that deep, carry a gun over her head and make it into land.
What was the trip like on that vessel from Honolulu over toward Guadalcanal? Was it a pretty crowded vessel? I mean, did you have room to even move around and sleep adequately, or what was it like?
Well, on them troop ships, you'd sleep in a hole and go down.
Yeah.
And sleep on those hammocks down there. They got hammocks down there.
Right.
But I was very fortunate on that, because whenever they went aboard ship, the mess officer had always come to me. They knew I could cook. They knew I'd worked in restaurants and things like that, and I was a waiter.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd come to me and ask me, would I wait on the officer's table?
Oh, okay.
And I volunteered for that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know it helped me to where I had a halfway decent place to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And to eat in as I eat what the officers eat,
oh,
you know.
Yeah.
And each time we would travel like that, that's what they would do. They'd come to me, and
so your training paid off. That's great. That's great. Eating in the officer, or at least eating the food, the same food the officer they have in the officer's
mouth. Well, aboard ship, the Navy saw that the officers had extra to beside what the troops had.
You know? Oh, yes.
But when we was out in the field, we all had the same thing.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
In other words, you couldn't tell a high-ranking officer from the biggest doughboy down there. You couldn't tell him. When Lightning Collins come through our line there, and you couldn't tell him what he was the biggest private in there.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't tell him.
Yeah, they didn't want to wear their rank on their
no,
to
sir.
Make a nice target. So on your ship then, you made out pretty well then because of your ability, training in the past. That's great. But the other guys that were down in the hole, they had very crowded quarters and very little room and about 6 inches
or
12 inches.
Oh, yeah. It was rough and it was hot down there most of the time.
And did you ever sleep out on the deck? Did you ever sleep out on
no,
the deck? No. Did you have good...
I was lucky enough whenever I volunteered to take care to take charge of the officer's mess, I usually had a stateroom.
Oh, okay. So you didn't need to.
And that way, I didn't have no duty as being a soldier only. Just that was my duty.
Yeah. So you were very, very reasonably comfortable. Let's put it that way. Okay. So on your way then to Guadalcanal, they tell you you're going to Guadalcanal. What, right? Just a day before you get there?
Yeah, two or three days before we got there.
Uh-huh. And what are your thoughts as going into combat? You must have talked to your fellow soldiers, and you must have...
Well, we just all tried to be brave, and I'd rather be alive carried as a dead hero anytime. but we knew what we were going to do, and we was trained for it.
You felt like you were well trained and ready to do what you were supposed to do?
Oh, yes. But we didn't know them Japs were going to be like they were. We didn't know they were going to be in dugouts.
Yeah.
They get in cave. They live just like rats now.
Yeah.
I hope the Japanese don't hear my saying, but they did. They live just like rats.
Yeah, in their caves. I understand. I understand your comparison.
Well, I guess maybe we was a little bit scared, shy, but we knew we had to do the job, so.
Okay, the day that you got to your launch point? I mean, did you sail right in and stay out there for a little while, or did you
unload? No, as soon as the boat stopped, we went out of there.
Okay.
We got out of there right quick, because we never knew when an enemy plane was going to come over.
Right. Tell me, what did they tell you as you're ready, or shortly before you got onto this invasion activity, what did your officers or sergeants or whatever tell you about as a reminder, last minute reminders, whatever, about what you needed to do? Did they tell you anything?
Well, they trained us.
Right before you're ready to unload,
yeah,
climb down the ladder.
They talked to us about everything. Of course, I was in the kitchen, but I got all the information.
Yeah.
See, I was right there with the officers.
Right.
And I got more information, I guess, than most of the troops.
Yeah, you probably would have, yeah. You probably overheard some conversation that others would not have.
You see, my captain, and three lieutenants was right in that bunch, so mm-hmm. I just talked to them just like I was talking to you right now.
Right.
Of course, out and meet them out somewhere, I was supposed to come to attention and salute, you know.
Right. Sure.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. But
okay, when you're ready to go over the side, did they have any last minute, person there to pray with you or to do anything, you know, at all? Or did you have any religious services?
No, we had a chaplain that we could go to. Now, he might have been sometimes a
rabbi or whatever.
Didn't know what denomination he was.
Yeah.
But I'll never forget when we went through the Marine lines, just before we got to the lines, the Gideons was there.
Gideons?
And Gideons was, and they was handing out New Testaments to everybody.
Right. That's the first I'd ever heard that.
And I'd been saved when I was just a young teenage boy.
Uh-huh.
I'd got away from the Lord, and I had too much pride to take one of those testaments. Now, I don't need that. But the Lord watched over me every step mm-hmm. of the way.
Sure did. So you're going over the side. You're crawling down that rope ladder down to that landing craft. I guess your thoughts are just, hey, I got to get down this rope ladder first. And then once you got in that landing craft, what did you, do you recollect what your thoughts were? I mean, were you kind of going over what you had to do?
We just consecrated on what we had to do. And mm-hmm. they told us it was going to be rough, and we just had to look out for ourselves and each other.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're going in toward Guadalcanal. About how far out were you? Do you recall how far the ship was out? A mile out, would you say, or a couple miles out? How far out was the ship? Do you have any recollection of that? I mean, was it like a half an hour ride into the beach, or?
Oh, no, maybe a 15 minute or something like that.
Okay.
They'd get us in there as quick as they could,
right,
and then go right back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just back and forth.
So you're in this landing craft now going toward the beach. You're in there with how many men, would you say? Probably 30 men or so, or?
No, I'd say 15 minutes, maybe about it.
No, I'd say 30 men were in that.
Oh, yeah, about 30 men.
About 30 men with
I'm
you.
Sorry, I'm hard to understand.
That's all right, no problem. So you're getting in toward the beach, and then what happens? You're hunkered down, I guess, out of watching for...
Not at Guadalcanal, because the Marines was holding a 12-mile beach here.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We got in, we set up our tents, and got all of our equipment in off of the boat and all that, taking a couple of 3 days.
Was there much rifle fire at all, enemy fire action at all?
No, we didn't have no action at all till we taken over the Marines' job.
Oh, okay.
And when we went through the Marines' lines, the Marines laughed at us and said, "Boys, we'll see you tonight." And one of the fellas spoke up and said, "Say, we're not Marines, we're the United States Army." But they told us stories that they would take ground of a night, and the Japs would take it away from a day, and the Japs would take it back at night.
Mm-hmm.
Said they'd crawl in the holes and cut their throats and everything like that.
Okay, we'll stop here.
This is an editor's note. End of tape A, side one. The interview continues on tape A, side two.
Okay, so you went through the Marine lines, and then the Marines
They laughed at us and said, "Boys, we'll see you again tonight." We didn't see them again till we went all the way through to the beach on the other side of the island.
So the Army was there. Was this the 25th Division or 27th? What was it?
That was the 25th Division.
25th Division.
And the 27th. I was in the. It takes. Let's see. It takes what? Three infantry regiments plus your heavy weapons and engineers and all that to make up a division.
Okay.
So. That was the 25th Division, and that's just C Company right there, but we went right through their lines.
Okay, so you kind of got all your men together in your company, right? You gathered together, and did your sergeant or lieutenant, whoever it was, what kind of instructions did he give you at that point, or did you know what you were supposed to do already?
Well, they told us. One day before we jumped off, after we'd done got our boat unloaded and got all of our equipment there and everything, they told us that, "Well, we're going to take over where the Marines from the Marines."
Mm-hmm.
The Marines had been there and they'd lost a lot of men.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Up through Tulagi and all up through, that's where they lost most of their men. The Marines had done a mighty good job. And they lost most of their men right up through Tulagi.
Mm-hmm.
And after we got through their lines, why then it was, I forget how many days it was, so we hit the beach on the other side.
Okay, so that first day after you passed the Marines' front line there and you got kind of organized with your company and your group, did you stay there or were you instructed then to go out on patrols?
We went through their lines, we were on the offense, and they were already in their possessions, and it's up to us to root them out.
Right. Okay. So what did you do then as a rifleman? What did you do at that point?
Well, I was a mortar man. I was in the weapons platoon.
Mortarman?
Yeah.
Okay.
And when we'd bed down for the night, why, there was three motors in there, and we'd set our motors up, and at night I'd fire three rounds, the other squad would fire three rounds, the other squad would fire three rounds.
Okay, and where did you get your target? Who told you what the target was?
Well, we just taught firing them for harassment.
Okay.
To keep the enemy from coming in.
Okay.
And then the artillery was behind us. They was firing over our heads all the time.
Did you have any idea where the enemy was?
No. Them Japs tie themselves up in a tree, at the top of a tree. And they could see all around them. And that was our big problem in snipers.
Did you get a lot of harassing fire from the trees then that's shooting at your group, your company?
Oh, yeah. And then they was in bunkers, dugouts. They had that place tunneled all to pieces. And they had them camouflaged. You walk right up on top of them, didn't even know.
So what did you do then from the standpoint of your getting set up and your rifleman?
I was armed at that time with a .45.
Okay.
Because I was the first gunner. And I carried
the mortar?
The mortar.
Okay.
Second gunner carried the bipod. And the rest of the men in our squad carried the ammunition.
Okay.
And as soon as, if we seen a target, our leader would be up ahead of us, and if he seen a target, he would give us hand signals, and the second gunner would run up, put the bipod down, I'd come up and put the motor on, and the carrier would come up with the ammunition, and then he'd give us signals of how far to shoot. See, we'd shoot over hills,
right,
and things like that. He'd tell us how far to shoot, and we'd fire around. If it fell short, he'd tell us how much to raise it.
Uh-huh.
If it's like that, it'd be maybe 500 feet, because it's hard to tell them jungles in there.
Oh, yeah.
So we went by signs,
mm-hmm,
and we'd raise it, fire again.
Mm-hmm.
If we went over, then he'd bring us back.
Mm-hmm.
See, he was seeing the target, we wasn't.
Right. So he was, how far would he have been from the target?
Well, he'd be in a place to where he could see them. Maybe
Okay.
he'd have to crawl up to the top of a hill,
yeah,
to where he could see.
He could see where the target was.
He could see the target.
And could see you at the same time. So.
But we used our motors most of the time for just harassing fire at night.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because in them jungles, sometimes you was in places you couldn't see 10 foot ahead of you.
Now, when you did your harassing fire, how far out would you shoot that motor? Would it be an eighth of a mile?
Oh, we'd shoot them sometimes 400 or 500 yards.
Okay.
And I'd every 15 minutes I'd fire three rounds. Every 15 minutes this other man fire three rounds.
Mm-hmm.
Another 15 minutes this one would fire. And the artillery was working the same way behind us,
mm-hmm,
only they was hitting short and long. They was treating. We had plenty of firepower behind us.
How about the ships, the battleships and cruisers? They were out there firing too, I take it?
Well, before we went in, the bombers would come in and bomb the places real good. And then battleships, they would blast it good. But now, if a man's under the ground, it takes a dead hit.
Yep.
So that was our problem. I don't care how much you bombard place, it took that old doughboy, the infantryman, to go in and get him.
They had to root him out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you... On Guadalcanal, were you basically a mortar man the whole time on Guadalcanal, or did you become a rifleman too?
No, I made squad leader after the first battle there. They was sending a patrol out, and they asked, they wanted my sergeant, he was a staff sergeant, to send out to go to take this patrol out, and he refused to take it.
Really?
And after that, we got to where we could, then they busted him down to a yard bird. Had to lower the private. Busted him down, made me squad leader.
So you promoted to sergeant then, or what?
No, then a squad leader was a corporal.
Corporal, okay.
Then just a little later on, then there was sergeants, and then later on, staff sergeants and all.
Mm-hmm.
And they put him in my squad. And there I was, the youngest squad leader and the newest squad leader. And I said to the first sergeant, I said, Sergeant Lafferty, I said, why'd you put Hobbs in my squad for? I said, these other two men's got more time than I have as leading. He looked straight at me and he said, Gibby, he said, you're a soldier, ain't you? I said, yeah, I guess I am. That's all it was saying.
Do your duty, huh?
So,
regardless. Well, tell me about that first, you said that first battle. They sent him out, the sergeant, he was going to be sent out, I guess, and then he indicated he would not go, right? Were you promoted right at that time?
I was promoted at that time. They made me corporal.
Mm-hmm.
They busted him, made me corporal.
Now, did you go out on your first patrol at that time, too, then, or what? Or when did you go out on your first patrol?
No, it was sometimes after that. We was in a pretty tough place. We'd been pinned down for 3 days and couldn't go nowhere. And they said they wanted each platoon to send a man out of each one of his squads on a patrol.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the other two squad leaders, I think they was on the water detail to get water. See, we'd have to get water where we could and put in our Lister bags, and then we'd fill our canteens up. And I was the only squad leader in there. And I taken one man out of my squad, I taken another man out of the other man's squad, and I went to another man, and that's what hurts me. He wasn't going. He said, I'm not going. And me and him hadn't got along too good before. And I cursed him, and I said, well, you'll either go or you'll go with me to the captain. And I said, you know what happens if you refuse to obey an order in time of war? I said, you know what's happened. So he went, and I helped bury him the next day.
Mm. That's tough. That's tough. Mm. So that was not a pleasant thing at all, was it?
Well,
that was a terrible.
I saw right there and then that I wasn't cut out to be a leader.
Mm-hmm.
But I carried on. So all that Guadalcanal was settled.
So did you have to go do the same thing over and over, go out on patrols? And
well, yeah, we'd go out patrol, and then the old company would move when they could.
Mm-hmm.
And what we would try to do is cut a bunch of them off, cut their communication lines,
mm-hmm.
and that's the way we do it.
Right. When you were going out to cut communication lines, what do you mean by that?
Well, they had these little field telephones,
mm-hmm.
and had little bitty wires,
mm-hmm.
and we'd run across one of them, we'd cut them.
So you were actually...
And then we'd try to cut them off from their company, see.
Right,
We couldn't follow the roads.
Yeah.
It was all jungle. We couldn't follow the roads.
Right, yeah.
Because they had a booby trap so bad you couldn't...
What were the booby traps like? How did they fix them?
Well, so they'd have them. You couldn't see them. You'd just walk right up on them when you walked through. Whenever you hit the trigger, off she'd go. Blow you up.
Were they mines or were they other kinds of booby traps?
Yeah, we just called them booby traps.
Yeah.
They were land mines.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then when you went out on these, on some of these patrols to cut communication lines, you were actually looking for these real thin wires, is that the idea?
Oh yeah, we could, if we get their communication lines cut, well then we could usually cut them off.
Yeah.
Because they had no communication to report our whereabouts, see.
Right.
And that's the main idea of fighting a jungle war.
Yeah.
Boy, this is a different one today though.
Yeah. Okay, if you found a wire, did you ever, were you ever instructed or said, told that you should follow that wire to wherever it leads?
That's what Joe Lightning done.
That's what he did.
He followed one up and surprised them, and he killed three Japs right there. Far from help, they said, just like John Wayne. I wasn't there. I just backed out.
Are you saying that your general did that?
Yeah, my
Joe
general
Collins did that?
That's where he got the name of Joe Lightning. He was a lieutenant.
I hadn't heard that story.
He's the man that led the great breakthrough for General Patton over in the European. After the Aquata Canal was over, then they transferred him, made him maybe a three-star general, sent him over. He was a good man.
What was his rank when he did this?
He was lieutenant general. He was my
He was already a lieutenant general.
Yeah.
Okay. But he personally...
He personally killed him.
Followed one of these lines.
He followed them lines. He come through our lines. I saw him at that time.
Yeah.
And he went right on. And then they captured three Japs.
Uh-huh.
And you know what they done with them?
I have no idea.
They brought them right down to my hole where I was at, dug in, set them down right there, said, all right, you guard these fellas. They wasn't hard to guard because they didn't have no money, they didn't have no guns, and they looked like they starved to death.
Mm-hmm.
They was poor snakes.
Mm.
Well, we give them some food. Give them cigarettes, and boy, I just tickled them to death. I guarded them for about 2 hours, and then they come and got them and took them to wherever they keep them. They were slow surrendering. I think that's the first three Japs that surrendered to us, the first three.
Is that right? So your time on Guadalcanal then was basically going out on these patrols and cutting communications and just making some kind of an offensive action against the Japs.
Well, they were on defense and we were on the offense. And we kept pushing them back. They went off over into another little island there. And
As you went on your patrols, what did you find in the way of caves that you had to go into and maybe?
Oh, they had caves dug, sometimes half a mile, and some of them mountains were rugged in there, and they dig big bunkers. They could see in four directions, every direction they could see. They had them camouflaged, you couldn't see them, and they had machine gun in this one, one in that, and one in that, and one in that.
Mm-hmm.
Four men in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it just taken a direct hit to get them out of there.
Yeah.
Or we learned to sneak up on them, and after we got flamethrowers, But I don't think we had flamethrowers until after we went to the Philippines. Mm-hmm. But we just had to root them out. That's the only way you get them. You could bombard them all you want to, and they were still there.
Okay, how long were you on Guadalcanal?
Well, I guess maybe we was on there about 6 months in the island, but not right on Guadalcanal. Mm-hmm. You see, they took us off up through Tulagi, up through there, where all the Marines had got killed. Mm-hmm. They took us up to Little Florida and Big Florida Islands. And we patrolled them islands for a few weeks there. Mm-hmm. And
this is before you went to Guadalcanal then?
No, that's after we went to Guadalcanal. After we didn't clear Guadalcanal. Well,
okay.
There was a few scattered in all them islands.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we stayed up there, and then they decided, well, gonna move on. Mm-hmm. So they decided they'd give us a little break, and they brought us back down. I know a destroyer picked us up and taken us back down to Guadalcanal, and then we took off to New Zealand, stayed about 6 weeks in New Zealand for a rest.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went back to Guadalcanal and started training to hit the Philippines.
Now, were there any remnants of Japanese on Guadalcanal when you got back? Didn't there still any problem?
Well, if they were, they was so back in the hills and so scared they didn't come out. They didn't. They didn't give us no trouble anyway.
Uh huh. No trouble at that point.
See, they had back weight on that Kolam Bangar. You see that last battle we was at. Going through Baroka Harbor Trail, I think it taken us 21 days. We called it Baroka Harbor Trail. I don't know if that's what it was. That's what we named it. And it's rainy season.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had two baths in a stream during that time. And I'd wash my clothes and put them right back on in the stream.
Mm-hmm.
And they dropped us one change of clothes from the plane.
Mm-hmm.
Parachuted them into us and some KS food. That's when it first come out at KS Ration.
Mm-hmm. K Ration, okay.
And that tastes so much better than that old pork and beans and hash. That's all I had, you know. I ate too much of it. Made me sick. Oh my goodness! But that was a pretty rough battle there. And we got down there through the Baroka Harbor Trail, and there was a lagoon went up through here, and Kolam Bangar was on this side over here. That's where the Japs had retreated to.
Uh-huh.
And we was right on this beach here, and they was on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, our artillery could shoot over there, and theirs could shoot over here. And they had big guns that they could pull in them caves, and then they'd pull them out.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd fire about 6 or 8 rounds and pull them right back in. And I was laying there in my hole under one of them bombardments, reading a letter that somehow our mail had got through. And I was reading a letter from my sister. She said she had went to see a, which I don't believe, a fortune teller. And so that fortune teller told her she had two brothers in the service and they're both going to come home safe. My brother was over there too, me and him was over there together.
Yeah.
So I was laying there reading that. I said, boy, I hope I don't know what she's talking about.
I guess so. Okay, well, let me just digress a second and go back to Guadalcanal and ask you some other questions that kind of just kind of fill out information. When you were in combat on Guadalcanal, what kind of uniform did you wear? What did you have on?
Fatigues.
You had fatigues. What kind of equipment did you have on you?
Well, we had a full field pack.
And what was in a full field pack?
Well, we had a shoulder knife. We had our little pick, our little shovel that went on the sides of it.
Uh-huh.
And we'd put a day's rations. We kept a day's rations in our pack all the time.
Uh-huh.
We had a blanket and a shoulder half. And then we had all our ammunition, and now that would be in our bag.
Mm-hmm.
And then we carry our ammunition. Of course, as long as I was doing the, I had ammunition carriers, because I had to carry that
mortar. Yeah.
And I was armed with a .45, so.
What did you wear on your feet? You had combat boots?
We just had them regular GI shoes.
Oh, okay. It weren't combat boots then, were you?
No, we didn't have the combat boots then. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We wore the regular Army shoes.
How much ammunition would you carry, typically?
We had an ammunition belt that go around us, and then you could put, I'd say, you could probably put 12, 14 clips in that belt.
Mm-hmm.
There was eight rounds to the clip.
Okay.
And now me, I had a .45, so I put other things in there. I didn't. My .45, I think it held about 12,
mm-hmm.
and I'd have two or three extra clips.
Mm-hmm.
It was all it was good for was a foxhole when you was in your foxhole.
Mm-hmm. You have a little trench digger, a little shovel, you said, too?
You had to dig your own hole. Whenever we dig in at night, we had to dig in. We'd dig in a big round circle, great big round circle, and about 3 foot apart. One man was supposed to stay awake in each one of those holes to warn the others till he got all the way around the perimeter.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How did you get your water daily?
Well, we'd have to find a stream somewhere, and we had them old big GI water cans like you've seen on a lot of these Jeeps and things.
Yeah, uh-huh.
We had them, and we'd send a water patrol out.
Mm-hmm.
They'd find water, and they'd carry it back, and we had our big old Lister bag. We'd set it up, and they'd pour that up. And we'd fill our canteens up. Mm-hmm. When we needed water, we'd go to there.
Yeah. And how about your food? You had one day's supply of food.
One day was supplied at the time.
And how were you resupplied with food?
Well, we had food. They had food carriers.
Uh-huh.
Now, in the Philippines volunteered. The Filipinos volunteered to carry our food to us, sir.
Okay. Well, let's go on then back to where we left off a little bit earlier then and carry on to your next island or wherever you went next.
Well,
you left off where the Japs were on this beach and you were on this beach and you were firing each other.
Oh, yeah, Colum Bengar.
Yeah.
We could hear them at night, their ships going up that side,
mm-hmm.
and they were evacuating them off of Colum Bengar, and they do it at night.
Mm-hmm.
And when we went into Colum Bengar, Why, we didn't find too much because they'd use one island to retreat to, and we get too strong on them, and they'd retreat to another.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
So where did you go then from there?
We went from there, like I said, back to Guadalcanal, or went to New Zealand, stayed there about 6 weeks, and then back to Guadalcanal, and then we trained to hit the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And they told us what we was training for that time.
Okay. In what time frame, how long were you in New Zealand? 6 weeks, you say?
How long was what?
You were in New Zealand's how long?
So maybe 6 weeks.
About 6 weeks. And during that period of time, was that rest or was that training also, you say?
Well, I got a little story on that.
Okay.
I told you about me sending that guy out on the patrol. The general was coming, and we was fixing to go on a parade for the general.
Mm-hmm.
We were in line marching to the parade field. And Lieutenant Allison, he was in charge of the officer's mess up there in headquarters, the regimental headquarters. See, I was in Company C up to now.
Mm-hmm.
So he come and drove his Jeep driver drove him right up to the front of our column, and he got out of the Jeep and walked along. We was marching. And he went to Captain Boyd and said, asked him, would he allow me to go and serve the colonel's table while the general was there?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they just stood there and marked time till I come up, see? And when I come up, well, I was the head of my squad, and I come up, Lieutenant, they just walked right along beside me, and he asked me, said, they want you to come and serve the colonel's table while the general's up there. Said, are you willing to go? I said yes, because I'd been drinking the night before and I didn't feel like parading. I wasn't feeling a bit good. So and I ain't proud of it, but the truth's the truth. And I was just glad to get out of that parade anyway. So I said, sure, I'll go. He said, just fall out. I just fell out with Lieutenant Johnson and got in his Jeep and we went to regimental headquarters. Well, they liked me up there, and they asked me, would I consider transferring to regimental headquarters? And I said I would. And Lieutenant Johnson took me back over to my company, and I went in and told Captain Boyd, I said, Captain Boyd, I said, they want me to transfer up to regimental headquarters and take over the colonel's table up there. He said, well, Ken, said, you know, said, you're up for sergeant. He says, I can't let you go with your rank, said the ranks in this company, I can't let it. He said, I'll have to cut you back. I said, Lieutenant, or Captain, I said, go ahead and cut me back. And I told him about, I said, I've done and found out that I'm not a leader in the Army. So he said, okay, if that's what you want. So I went back to a private. Went up there and taken over the king's. I'm not the king,
the
but
colonel's
the colonel's table.
Might as well be a king.
And so I was then out of most of the fighting right then. So See, regimental headquarters, they in the back all the
right,
time.
Right, yeah, right.
So that was in New Zealand, and we left New Zealand and went to train for the
Philippines.
And when we went to the Philippines, why, like I say, board ship, I fared good. And then we got to the Philippines, why, then I just, when we was in war, I mean, everybody was in it, so I had to pull guard just like everybody else did.
So when you were in the Philippines, did you actually go ashore then, or were you on ship, or what did you do?
We went to the Philippines. Why? We landed at Lungan Gulf.
Lungan Gulf, yeah.
See, we hit it in three directions.
Right.
And the 25th Division went in at Lungan Gulf.
Right.
And we went, we had to jump out of the boats.
So it's kind of like Guadalcanal all over again?
And they had bombarded it good. We didn't hit too much opposition when we first went in.
Yeah.
But we hit plenty of it after we got in.
Now, what were your duties then after you went ashore at Lingayen Gulf then in the Philippines?
Well, I was in regimental headquarters. Mm-hmm. I carried a gun. I stood guard. We had to have guards. And the colonel and everybody else, when you're in combat, they dig for themselves. Of course, the men would dig his hole, you know, for him to sleep in. And we couldn't go the roads at all. We had to take bulldozers and make our way through them jungles.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in that book where the bulldozer, it was so bad that the men couldn't move forward. And that bulldozer operator, Satan, raised his blade up to protect him, and the men got behind that blade and followed him till they got, that guy with the flamethrower got close enough to throw his flamethrower in there.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, so
it's in that book.
Yeah, the man with the bulldozer raised his blade,
yeah,
protected the troops so they could attack this
particular point.
Huh?
And when he run out of gas, and there he was. And them Japs are coming out of there. He'd got so much gas in there they couldn't stand it. He had to get out of there.
Yeah.
And as they run out, he got 26 of them. He hit him in the head with his flamethrower. He's right in that.
Yeah, right. That's incredible. What a story. Now, you were not there, I take it. You were back at regiment.
Oh, I was back. I wasn't right up there.
But this is what you heard, though, anyway.
Well, yeah. I mean, I heard it that day.
Yeah.
I mean, we kept in contact with each other all the time.
Oh, yeah.
So everything come back to regimental headquarters.
Yeah. So what were your duties during the day at regimental headquarters? Were you basically cooking and serving and this kind of thing?
Oh, no. When we was out in combat, I taking care of Ken, they taking care of their own self.
Mm-hmm.
He rations just like the rest of us.
So they were up close enough in combat where they didn't have any special kind of mess or anything, huh?
No. Well, in combat, you couldn't tell an officer from nobody else.
Yeah. So they were close enough where they had to do just like everybody. So was that your duties then basically from the Philippines?
In other words,
guard duty and back with regimental headquarters.
Regimental headquarters stayed as close to the front as they could.
Mm-hmm.
And me and another guy would dig in together. Me and him had worked together. He was the other waiter for the rest of the officers. Mm-hmm. And me and him would always dig in together and protect each other. Mm-hmm. And in this certain place, on that Ligayen Gulf, we was going through the Ligayen Gulf, and we were in this place, and they put me and him on a 50 caliber machine gun, a covering that road that the bulldozer had made up through there. Mm-hmm. And everybody else was around, the colonel right in the middle. And one night, it was in them jungles, it's so dark you couldn't see your hand in front of you. But where the bulldozer had come through and built this road through there, they set this machine gun up here, but we had a dugout up there that we'd get in, and we had to guard that road at night.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you couldn't see anything.
Huh?
You couldn't see anything.
Well, no, but...
I know you were guarding it.
Well, we had that thing set right on that road. If anything coming up that road.
Yeah. And well, you would hear it probably.
Yeah. And we were sitting there one night, and I was supposed to be awake. He was supposed to be asleep. But it was a little early, and neither one of us wasn't asleep yet. So we heard something. The jeeps was right down below us. All the officers, jeeps and all, was right down below us. Mm-hmm. And we heard something down there. And we're supposed to warn, find out what's there before we shoot. Well, I said, Billy, I said, we got enemy in camp. They was already inside our premises.
Really?
And I said, I said, we can't shoot. We can't see them. But we could hear them in them jeeps. They're hunting something to eat. They'd been cut off, see? Oh. They were four of them.
They were scavenging.
And I said, Billy, I said, I know you can't see, but I said, keep me covered. Now, you see, I was up here. They were down here. They were down here. And any time you're down below, and you can pick anything up in the skylight. And that's one time, I guess, about as scared as I ever was in my life. But I said, Billy, we got to warn the troops. I said, you just keep me covered. And I got up. Now, I don't care much about this being on tape because... But anyway, I got up. I went to the first hole. Both men was asleep.
Uh-huh.
I woke them up. I went to three holes. Both men was asleep, and each one was supposed to stay awake.
Right.
See, they was feeling now up on the front lines, buddy. We know better than go to sleep, but I have had them go to sleep on me like that. But I went to three holes and had to wake them up. I said, now wake everybody up around this perimeter. I said, we got enemy in here. And the radio, there are two radio operators was, well, they were from southern end of the road down there from where I was at. And I knew I had to get to them because everybody had a radio in there and need to be awake, you know, the colonel and all. So I said, well, I called up there to the radio and both of them was asleep.
Oh, boy.
I never mentioned it. I mentioned it after I got home, but I never mentioned it because I could have called men to get...
Yeah. Yeah, big trouble.
And the radio man woke up and they got on that radio and then things began to stir. One man had seen them down there. They was up above him, and he could see them. And he shot at it. His gun jammed on him. That scared him to death. He started hollering, "Somebody get him! Somebody get him!" He said, "My gun won't shoot." And well, me and Billy, where we was at, if we shot, we'd go shooting right straight into the perimeter on our trier men.
Yeah.
So we couldn't do it. But somebody finally did. They killed three of them.
Oh.
And one was right at the colonel's hole where they killed him.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
And one jumped off that big high bank into the road. It was high. We heard him hit that, and then out down through that woods he went. I don't know if he killed himself or not,
yeah.
But I know he was getting out of here.
I guess he was.
And I did. I got a little wound that night, but I never said a word about that.
How did you get the wound?
Fell down.
Oh, you fell down.
When I was coming back from the radio.
Uh-huh. Right?
And I went to the aid station the next morning. They said, "How'd you do that?" I said, "I just fell down." I wasn't about to say anything because they'd got somebody in trouble there.
Yeah, right.
I'd probably got Purple Heart if I'd told them what happened.
Okay, we'll stop right here now.
This is an editor's note. End of tape A, side 2. The interview continues on tape B, side 1.
Okay, so that was your experience on the Philippines. How long did you stay there? Was there anything else you wanted to bring out on that?
There's 165 days. That book tells you about everything.
Yeah.
The high points.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Of course, it was rough. That Philippines was rough. I mean, and I understand that there's still a few stray Japs back in them mountains yet.
They're mighty old if they are.
But now them Filipinos was glad to see us come
in.
Yeah,
I should say. How did they express their joy at seeing
you? Oh, they just, you could see it all over them. They just tickled to death.
Mm-hmm.
And
did they give you things or, you know, this kind of thing?
Well, they were looking for things from us most of the time.
Okay. Looking for food, I guess, is other things.
General MacArthur left there with these famous words, "I will return."
Yep.
Well, I was there when he come back and says, "I have returned."
Right. Did you view that?
I didn't view that.
You were there.
But I got it right. Well, I was still there. I was there. Well, this type of, as soon as we got a good beachhead, here he comes.
Yeah, right. So, did you know that he was coming? Did you have any inkling that he was going to be coming?
Well, no, we didn't know it until he actually arrived. I don't know, because everything was military secret now.
Yeah, right.
Seemed like our news media tell everything's happening around now. It don't seem like we got any more military secret.
Doesn't seem that way, does it? So after he then came back to the Philippines, this was after the Philippines were secured, I take it, and there were...
Well, no, they were still a lot of fighting after he got back.
Uh-huh.
As soon as they got it cleared out enough so he could get in,
mm-hmm.
got the airfield and all.
Yeah. So did the fighting continue a long time after that?
Oh, it continued. That Belady Pass, that was a rough spot. That was all through mountains. Our engineers built roads up mountains so steep that our four-wheel drive trucks couldn't even come up them.
Hmm.
They had to winch them up.
Really? Hmm.
Now, we had to climb them.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were back in battalion, right?
I'm back in headquarters.
Regimental headquarters.
All the way through the Philippines.
Yeah, you're back in headquarters.
Because when I got a chance to get out like I did, I said I better just go ahead and take this right now.
Yeah. So what were your activities then after MacArthur got back and so forth? What did you do as they proceeded along?
I stayed right there in them hills till they started letting them out on after the European theater was over.
Mm-hmm.
They started turning them loose, and by the time we was on that Belady Pass when they come and told me that I could come home.
Really? And there was a fighting still going on in the Philippines?
Oh yeah, there was still fighting. I got
up
discharged.
Up in the hills, I'm sure.
I got discharged 16 days before the war was over.
Before VJ Day.
Yeah. I was there when it started, and I like 16 days. Of course, I still wore till I got back here.
Yeah.
Cause them, we zigzag all the way back.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I came back the same route I went.
Uh-huh.
All the way to the...
how did you learn that you might be able to get out? How did you know that?
Oh, well, as soon as they started letting them out, we all knew that. And they started with seniority.
Yeah, the number of points that you had, right?
Yeah.
You used the point system, right?
Mm.
And
seniority, that's your time.
Yeah. Time would relate to points, and battles would relate to points and what have you. So anyway, you had enough that you could be discharged. Now when they... How did you learn that you would be discharged? Did you know that you had enough points, or were you checking?
They come told me. I said, "Gibby, we're going to let you go home."
Oh, okay.
Well, now the first time, I hate to tell this, but I'm going to tell it anyway. The first time, I'd went back to the rear echelon. I had a driver went back. And we got to drinking, and we went back to South, I think that was San Jose, and I went out and got in the Jeep. I wanted to go up and get a little old radio I had, but I drank so much, I remember starting, but I don't lie, the next thing I knowed, I was in an ambulance.
Oh, my word.
I drove that Jeep and run into left the road over to one of them rice paddies.
Mm-hmm.
And just stopped it like that, towed me out of the Jeep. And they didn't do anything about it till my time come to come home that first time. And one of the captains said, "Well, now wait a minute." Said, "There he wrecked that Jeep, lost three guns in that rice paddy." And he said, "We just better hold him back." That's the only time I'd ever felt like I'd never get to come home again.
So how long did they hold you back?
I guess I stayed another 6 or 8 weeks.
Oh, really? Well, significant.
And then the captain, or the colonel one, said, "I think Gibby served enough time," said, "let's let him go home."
So how did you get home? What, you took a ship
home? I come home, board a ship.
And was it a military ship, I think?
Yeah, it was military all the way.
Converted?
They had... What burned me up, they had 300 litter cases on that ship. And they was flying well-able men home at that time to show what the Army was doing for the soldiers. They didn't fly me back. They put me on one of them ships, and they had all them litter patients on there.
It should have
been.
Some
of them died.
Yeah, should have been.
Now, why didn't they fly them litter patients back instead of flying them well-able men?
Yeah, that's a
but,
very
you
good
know,
question.
They got to make a big show somewhere. So.
Yeah. So you got back to the U.S. Where did you come in, San Diego or?
No, I came right back to Charleston, South Carolina.
Oh, through the canal and everything?
Yeah,
back
I come
to
back through the canal again.
Oh, okay. I'm surprised they wouldn't let you off on the West Coast and take a train or something. But you came all the way back to Charleston.
Came all the way back to Charleston.
And then where were you actually released from duty?
Charleston. Discharged me in Charleston.
Uh-huh. And then you came back to Taylorsville, is that the idea?
No, I came back to Bryson City.
Bryson City, okay, you weren't, I got Taylorsville on the mind. Okay.
See, I didn't come to Taylorsville to live till after I retired.
Oh, okay.
I went to General Motors after the war and got a job with them, and I stayed there till I could retire with them.
I see.
And then I'd come back to Taylorsville once a year, sometimes for a four-week vacation.
Mm-hmm.
I just kind of liked it there.
Mm-hmm.
So when I retired, well, in fact, I bought my property, bought my phone.
Mm-hmm.
And I just come back there and retired.
I see.
Got as far back in the sticks as I could and built me a house and ain't missed that hustle and bustle of Michigan.
Oh, that's great. Okay, so anyway, you got discharged, you went back to Bryson City, and then where did you go to work after you got back?
Well, I come up to Asheville, and I was like a worm in hot ashes. I was a nervous wreck. I got a job at the Dr. Pepper Bottling Company. I was there when VJ come. They give us a day off.
Uh-huh.
And they put me on there as an inspector. All I had to do was sit there and make sure there's nothing in them bottles before they got filled up. That was the tarfest job I ever had in my life. Good for about 2 hours. Then you get sleepy, you get an old guy, just sitting there and gazing them bottles all the time.
So you didn't stay there long, I tell you.
No. Oh, I didn't stay nowhere for a while. I went from there to Inca, and then my brother came over from Tennessee. He got discharged a long time before I did. And he come home from Tennessee, and he wanted me to go over there. I went over there and started working over there.
Is that for General Motors then?
No, I stayed in Tennessee. I was about a year after I got discharged, I went to General Motors.
Uh-huh, okay.
Well, I went to General Motors 10-10-51.
Okay.
And I stayed there 26 and 2/10 years.
Which plant was that?
GMC Truck and Coach.
And where was it physically located?
Pontiac.
Oh, Pontiac, okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, so you've been up in the north then, huh? Okay. You were in Pontiac, Michigan, I take it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So we're both from up in that country. I'm from Moline, Illinois, which is a little ways away, but same latitude. Cold. So you stayed up there, and then when you retired, you came back down here. Then you came to Taylorsville, is that
yeah.
It? Okay. Then you came to Taylorsville and been there ever since, and been enjoying that. Let me ask you another couple questions. Why did you go in the Army versus the Navy or something else?
Well, because I had a brother-in-law in there, I guess, and I didn't know. I just know country born, didn't know nothing. I mean, you know.
Yeah, the Army was as good as anything. Huh?
The only education I've got is I've got it from my Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Man experience.
Oh, yes. Okay. What do you think about the leadership that you had during your time in service, especially in combat?
Well, I agreed with most of it.
Did you respect the people that were over you?
I definitely did. I've seen so many come in that never knowed what respect was, didn't know how to take orders. And buddy, back then, when you come in the Army, if you were like that, you had a rough time. I'd always learned, I'd always mind at home. I'd always had bosses over me. I had no problem.
Yeah, right. So you were a good soldier, in other words. How was the discipline in your group, especially during your combat time? Did you have guys that, you know, kind of wanted to do their own thing versus following instructions?
When we'd be in actual combat, they stuck together a whole lot better than we really expected them to.
Mm-hmm.
We had to. That's no ifs and ands about it. We had to.
Okay. Did you have any trouble with any gambling or people going AWOL, this kind of thing?
No, not after we got overseas. They didn't have nowhere to go. So, now gambling,
plenty of that, didn't you?
That there. Well, that's all we had to do when we get our paychecks. I gambled. I was a blackjack player. Pretty good at it too. That's whenever, if you blackjacked, you got the deal. And I had some men in there that would double up and catch up. That's all you hear, double up and catch up. I didn't put no limit on it. I just let them double up. And every time I could, I'd send my mother for $400.
Really? So you made a few extra bucks, huh?
And my brother, he said, well, you're trying to make a fool out of me. So he started sending mama money. Bought the first home she ever owned.
Isn't that something? From blackjack.
Well, I sent her an allotment every month.
Yeah.
I had so much, took out my check every month and sent it to my mother.
Uh-huh. Did you ever see anybody from the Red Cross or the USO or anybody else? Did they ever do anything for you?
Oh yeah, a lot of them USO people come through. I mean, I don't remember a lot of their names, but there was a lot of them come through. And when they come to our outfit, well, they couldn't come only when we'd be stationed at some place.
Mm-hmm.
Then I had the officer's kitchen, so I had to have to serve them.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to meet all of them.
Yes, you did. Yeah, you met some famous people along the line, I guess.
Well, I had to propose to Alice Faye's sister. Right in front of all
them
people.
Had you heard that
people.
Before?
All them people.
Isn't that funny? That's great.
I spilled soup on her and I was serving her that night. Boy, then a captain come to me and said, now, Ken, I said, you people come on down now as soon as you get everything cleaned up. I said, okay. He had us seats right down in the front.
Uh-huh.
I think she told him to do that. Just as soon as I sat down, she come on stage. She said, I want you. She remembered that.
That's true.
That was embarrassing.
Oh, sounds like fun to me. Tell me what's your opinion of the enemy that you were facing back then in combat? What did you think about their ability, their tactics and this kind of thing? Did you ever think about it, or was it just?
Well, we knowed we had a tough job on hand. We knowed that as soon as we got over there. Well, we already figured it out, but sneak attack they pulled on us.
Uh-huh.
And I heard that ambassador of Japan say right after the World Trade Center on television, why would they pull a sneak attack like that on America?
Yeah.
I said, you hypocrite Jew, why did you pull one in Pearl Harbor?
Yeah, exactly right. How is the morale of your unit, would you say, especially in combat?
Well, I've seen boys that shot themselves through the hand. I've seen them shoot themselves through the foot. But, he was, I think we was all scared, but I was more, I does take chances on coming out alive, and I would wounded in any way.
Yeah. How about psychological stress? I mean, there were a lot of, you know, in combat, obviously, you have a lot of pressure
and fear. Yeah, they...
Did you have anybody that you're aware of? Of course, I think you mentioned the sergeant that refused to go out on patrol. So that was one instance of somebody who was so stressed out they couldn't do their job. Anything else you can think of that...
I think of a time or two whenever right in the middle of the night some feller just go from off of it and just start screaming. They had to send a few home like that.
Yeah. So you saw a few cases of that then, huh? How about, did you work any with our allies, any of the British or any other countries in any of your activities at all over there?
No, we didn't. Our outfit didn't come in contact with
people from any other country. Any of our allies. Okay. How did you learn about VJ Day? You were here in the States, right?
I was working in the Dr. Pepper Bottling Company, and it come over the radio.
Came over the radio.
And boy, it went through that plant fast and make your head swim.
Boy, and you were.
And they sent us home right there and said, you've got the day off.
Well, and I guess you felt, well, I did my part, huh?
Well, I just done what I had to, that's all.
Yeah, you and a lot of other people.
I didn't volunteer. Like I said at the start, I'd rather be a live coward than a dead hero.
Tell me how you would characterize your service. What do you think about what you did in the service?
Well, I really don't know. It's just, I had to do it. It's just something we had to do. That's all there was to it. We just went ahead and done it.
Do you have any particular event in your, particularly, you know, your time period in combat or any time during that period that is very memorable to you, that you think is kind of the maybe a high point in your service or something that is particularly memorable to you?
Well, there's a lot of good times and a lot of bad times. A lot of good times, a lot of bad times. A lot of things we can look back at now in life that we couldn't, wasn't life and matter then.
Absolutely. Okay, and it just kind of a final question. How did your time in service affect your, change your life and affect your future?
Well, I was a nervous wreck when I come out of service. I sure was. And I went ahead and got married. And you know the Bible says that there's pleasures in sin, but it's only for a season. And I thank the Lord that I realized when my season was up.
Mm-hmm.
I realized it. My children were just little bitty fellas.
Mm-hmm. Well, bless you. You are one of the greatest generation. Anything else you'd like to add, Ken, before we close this up?
No, I think I've said enough.
Okay, well, that'll conclude our interview with Mr. Ken Gibby then. Thank you, sir.
Okay.